Welcome to A Longer Table Podcast, a space where curiosity and proximity will challenge everything you thought you knew. I'm your host, Amanda Carpenter, inviting you to pull up a seat. You just might leave thinking, maybe we're not so different. Blaine, we are finally having this conversation months, maybe even almost a year after we talked about having this conversation.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, you've moved. I've moved. You were transitioning into a really exciting new part of your life. Life happens. So yeah. I'm very delighted for us to be having this conversation now that we're having it.
I know. Everything in its right time. When That's I read right. your book, Exit the Cave, I was like, oh my goodness, there are so many similarities in our stories. Like, I feel like Exit the Cave and Soul Care to Save Your Life have so much in common. Obviously, we each have our own story, but there's just so, it seems like the journey that you and I have both gone on and are continuing on is so similar. And it's such a personal book. It's such a vulnerable book. And I'm just curious, like, why you wrote it.
Well, I intended to write a completely different book. I thought I was initially writing a book about the creative process. I had spent, you know, many, many years, almost two decades as a professional actor. And then I had spent another decade as the creative director of a megachurch, which is a very weird job to have. And I had begun transitioning from that into professional directing as a commercial director and starting to do some TV and film stuff. And I had amassed this sort of, this is how you make things sort of philosophy. And so I was attempting to write a book about that. And I'd always been in, go ahead.
I was going to say, that doesn't surprise me because from what I've gathered in knowing you, but not really knowing you, like knowing you through our mutual friends and social media, is you've become really successful in your work as a filmmaker, director, all the things, correct me if I say the wrong titles, but like you even did a commercial with, oh gosh, what's the celebrity's name? It was like not a Botox, but like some sort of commercial.
Yeah. Joe Jonas.
Like
Joe Jonas. I've had my breakout work outside of being an evangelical megachurch has been working with celebrities like LeBron James, Cindy Crawford, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Julia Michaels, Usher, Joe Jonas. And Joe Jonas, yes, he is a brand ambassador for a product called Xeomin, and it is a Botox alternative. And I spent the morning tucking Joe into bed because the first shot was him getting out of bed. And it was a very small set. And so I needed to be there with him. And so I kept texting some of the women friends that I had that I know would be very jealous of the job that I had that morning, which was like, I'm tucking Joe Jonas into bed again and again and again. So yes, I've been very lucky. It's a very weird life that I have been given. Yeah, it's weird.
You've like found yourself in a pretty successful, fun, it seems like at least, role.
Yeah, it's very fun. I mean, you know, making something for yourself, no longer being in some sort of corporate structure that's 9 to 5 that, you know, you don't always know what you're going to get paid that month. And sometimes things are up and sometimes things are down. We're talking right now and we're many weeks into the writer's strike. And I still am a member of SAG, which is the Screen Actors Guild. A month ago, our union authorized to strike. And so, you know, I do a lot of different things, which is great for us to diversify our income. But, you know, for any of you who are entrepreneurs or are trying to make it on your own or to kind of follow a passion and try to turn that passion into a vocation or something that makes you money, that puts food on the table, some days are deliriously exciting when I'm on set or I'm working on a new idea. And then there are also really, really horrific days where I'm a 7. So I'm a very deep feeler of like, I'll never work again. And this is it. That was the last one. they're never going to call me again. And I feel that so deeply. And then of course that's not the case, but, it's really fun, and it's afforded me some really crazy opportunities to work with some very interesting people, like tucking Joe Jonas into bed in Miami for a morning. Yeah.
So you set out to write a book about all that stuff, really about the creative process and how you kind of got to the space that you're in now. What shifted? Because that is not the book that Exit the Cave came to be.
I know. So I had that idea, and then I'd always had this story that I was told in a humanities class when I was 17, kind of always bubbling to the surface when I thought about the creative process. In brief, it's Plato's allegory of the cave, and it's his idea of how someone gets to the truth or gets to a new idea. And it's basically the story that he shares is, imagine a cave, and in the cave is a tribe of people, and they're chained to the floor, and they're being forced to look up at the cave wall. And what they're looking at are shadows. But to them, the only thing they think that they know are the shadows. To them, the shadow is the reality. But behind them is an artifice. There's a walkway, and there's this giant fire, and there are people that are assigned to walk the objects past the fire to create the shadows. So there's a tree, or there's a dog, or the chair. He kind of gives all these objects. The story goes that one day our hero stands up and realizes that the chains that they thought that they've been attached and locked to the cave with aren't even locked, and they slide right off their wrist. And they look around and they see the shadows and they see the fire, and they begin to realize, oh, this isn't reality. This isn't the truth. This isn't real. And so they look at the fire, but beyond it, they see this white dot, and they begin moving towards the dot. Of course, the dot grows larger because that person is exiting the cave. And so they keep moving, but the closer they get to the light, the harder it gets. But now they've gone too far and they can't go back. And so they keep moving and moving and moving until they've made their way out of the cave. Their eyes finally adjust to the light. They see the tree, they see the dog, they see the chair. And then there's this amazing twist at the end of the story, because what the hero doesn't do what you expect that they would do, which is run away from the cave as far as they can go. Instead, they re-enter the cave. They go back into the darkness. They stand before the tribe that all still thinks that they're looking at the truth, which is the shadows. They still think they're all locked in place. And the hero says to them all, there's so much more. And I remember hearing that story when I was 17, in the midst of some of the darkest pain places of my own story. I had experienced sexual abuse when I was a kid. My dad was an alcoholic in and out of our home. My mom was a really severe diabetic and experienced seizures all the time. And so my brother, who is 4 years younger than I, we lived a pretty kind of rough childhood. And I remember listening to that story as a 17-year-old, wondering if that was true. Is there more? Like, is there something better than the shadows I've been looking at? And then as a creative professional, many, many, many years later, realizing, oh, that's how you make stuff. Like, you uncover something of your own truth, and then you go back into the dark spaces and tell everybody there is more. That's art. That's going to the theater. That's listening to a piece of music. That's reading a book. And so I thought I was going to talk about the creative process in light of that, and knew I'll probably touch on a little bit of my story. And then our church fell apart. All of our friends moved. The pandemic hit, and I began doing what every successful author does with their agent and publisher, which is ignore all of their emails. And so for about a year and a half, that's what I did, because I was in this kind of inner personal tumult. And I was like, how can I write about this? This, none of this feels like it matters. It's not, who cares? In many ways, I was like, the original idea was a shadow. And then I had an amazing opportunity to spend an afternoon with Rob Bell and a group of people. And basically, we sat in a circle, and all of us came with an idea or a question or a struggle. And Rob Bell, if you know him, you know, this wise sage, my turn comes up, I step up to the plate, and I say, this is what I'm working on. And he's like, well, why do you have to write what you propose to your publisher? And I was like, oh, because I have a contract. He's like, who cares about the contract? What is the book that you would write? What is the story that you want to tell, and how would you really want to tell that? And also, you know, we talked before we even started the podcast, all the mutual friends that we have, it's sort of this sort of leadership, pastor, church kinds of circles. How many of those people have written books? And all of them, or many of them, wrote them in very specific ways. It's like they tell you a story and then they sort of preach the story, you know, the application of it. Mm-hmm. And when I began writing that in kind of the creative process, Exit the Cave, Plato's Allegory book way, it just felt so inauthentic. And I would get so confused. My brain would get so foggy. And it was only when I just was writing the stories of my life that I realized there was energy there. And that was the other thing that Robert said. He said, where's the energy? And just follow that. And so I did. I eventually emailed my agent. They said, hey, can we get on a Zoom call? And on that call was a woman I had never met. I realized that they had bamboozled me into an intervention, and she was to be my writing coach.
Oh my goodness. That's hilarious.
And so for the next 6 months, I owed her 1,000 words a day based on prompts, based on my story. And that is what the book became. And so really the book is a turn from what I thought was a collection of, you know, kind of a treatise on the creative process into a memoir that was my story told in a vulnerable way that felt like I have to tell these stories or else I can't move on to the next creative thing in my life, hoping that if I were vulnerable in telling these stories, that others would have the courage to do the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, well done. And I actually love that they brought in a writing coach and offered you those prompts, because if that's what helped get the book to where it, you know, ended up landing, then it was worth it. And I hope you feel the 100%. Same way.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I think I think we have this idea of in any creative endeavor, how we think we're supposed to do it based on how you may have seen other people do it. And sometimes that's really helpful. Because you see, oh, there's a path and I could try that way. And sometimes that path just isn't the right one for you. And I realized me going into a cabin for 6 months and writing something by myself was not the way that I was going to be able to write a book. I needed to do it with a team. I needed to have a coach. I needed to have Margaret, my wife, who's the real writer in our home, be reading it and giving me feedback. And so it really became way more of a team sport than I thought, you know, a solo, endeavor.
Yeah. Yeah. That is so true. I've told so many people that my name shouldn't be the only one on the spine of my book because so many people play such a big role in it. In the book, you talk about the gift of addiction, and I want to go there for just a couple of minutes. Are you willing to be vulnerable and sharing here what addiction you're referring to and a little bit more about the gift of it?
Yep. I only have one gear, Amanda, and that is to be an oversharer. So
me too.
You
and me both.
Yeah. So, my abuse, sexual abuse, when I was 10 years old at the hands of a couple of neighborhood boys, pushed me into a world of sexual addiction. I didn't realize until later in life that my dad also suffered from the same addiction. It just wasn't something that we spoke about. His alcoholism was always kind of at the forefront. As I learned more of his story, eventually I understood that that was places that he had fallen victim as well. And when I was maybe 23 years old, I began having all of these panic attacks that I couldn't understand where they were coming from, because professionally, things were amazing. I was living in Chicago. I was working at all the great theaters in town, Chicago Shakespeare, the Goodman Theater. I got my SAG card at doing Prison Break, which is a TV show that was in Chicago for a long time. Everything was kind of going up and to the right. I was going back and forth to New York, reading and auditioning for Broadway producers. It just seemed inevitable that my career was going to continue to take off. At the same time, all of these panic attacks began happening. And I realized the connection because I was at the height of my addiction. I was paying for sex, anonymous partners, lots of pornography. And I couldn't control it. And it was just the kind of quintessential phrasing or definition of addiction, of being able to, you know, not be able to stop something you want to stop doing. And so when I started having these panic attacks, I re-entered therapy. And it was in that process that I started realizing the gift of addiction is to show you the life and death consequences of what you do every single day. You know, I had seen it play out with my dad, and he passed away a number of years ago because of his addiction. And I knew that I didn't want that. And I think that addiction gives you this bright, shining light in the places in your heart, in your soul, in your story that need care. And so we're all addicted to something. It's just that some of us are gifted with the big ones, the ones that really will take your life away if you go too far. All of us are addicted to something, and it's numbing us. It's casting a shadow over us. It's preventing us from living a full life. But addiction really is just showing you the places in your story that need care. And so to me, I recognize that as a tremendous gift, that if I was faced with the opportunity of being able to look at those places that needed care and give them the care that they needed, what could that do to my life? How could that change my story? And then ultimately, how could that change the story of my family?
Mm, yeah. And have you gotten a lot of feedback from people who've read your book that by reading what you've shared, even if they can't relate directly, that it's illuminated for them what caves they might be in or find themselves in, or what addictions they might actually be struggling with? Again, they may not be the same as what you've experienced or what I've experienced. Totally. They may seem much less consequential, and like you said, may not be like life or death, but still have a significant impact on the quality of a person's life, or their potential, or where, how far they go in their career, or if their marriage lasts, you know, the different things that can happen. What is the feedback been?
Yeah, it's been surprisingly agnostic. Now, certainly there are people that are really specific who have encountered some of the same addictions as myself and have said, oh, this gave me the courage to get the help that I needed, or to speak out about a certain dark place that I had been finding myself. But for the most part, what I'm hearing is it's just like watching any great movie, of watching a hero kind of work through their stuff. It gives you some kind of courage to do the same, no matter what it is that you're going through. And that was really my hope in writing the book and speaking so vulnerably about my specific addictions. It makes me think of two thoughts. One, in storytelling language, we often think, if I want to speak to the biggest audience, I have to be as general as possible. Like kind of what you're saying, oh, I need to make sure it hits everybody. But in truth, good storytelling, it's the things that are the most specific that are the most universal. So I think that is something that I really have felt in the feedback. And then in recovery language, we use this phrase a lot, and it's, if you make it, we make it. And so I think people reading any kind of story of someone who's made it or is making it or has attempted to make it gives you some amount of energy to know that, oh, maybe I could do the same.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like by you sharing your story and your journey and people seeing that healing is possible, that hope and restoration are within reach for you, that maybe it's also within reach for them. And
that's right.
And you, I think you do a good job of both getting like tangible and specific about that in the book, but also just being real about how transformation, like, it's not just like a one-time thing or an overnight thing. It's like, it's a journey that we're on indefinitely, essentially. But your life today, where you're at today, do you still find yourself like struggling in the cave or in any caves? Where do you feel like you're at now? Like, is this all a thing of the past, or what like re-trips you up or kind of What's something that you think you'll just kind of forever be working through?
That's such a great question. I mean, it is a forever thing, addiction. And I feel like, again, knowing if we were to agree on the language that we're all addicted to something, we all get to be on this journey forever. It really is a one day at a time sort of mentality. I think that the things that trip me up still really are an idea. So sevens are horrible at believing that there is more, like that the world is an abundant place, not a scarce one, that there will be bread tomorrow, there will be manna in the morning, like there will be more. So I think for me, and that is probably one of the spaces that, because addiction, specifically what I had mentioned earlier, and really any, is just like, there's never enough. There's never enough. And so I'd say that now, where what's never enough is like, ooh, never enough jobs, or never enough money, or never enough, I'll never be healthy enough, or I'll never be, those are the places that move me into sort of the same headspace, even though how I act out is so very different than how I used to. But that is a place that I continue to stay aware of, and really to find grace for myself, to go, oh yeah, that's just like, it's a meditative practice to go, oh, there's that thought, and just let it pass, and not judge it, and not judge me for thinking that thought. And knowing that it'll pass, and not being unkind to myself, I feel like is also a giant lesson that all addicts need to learn. My dad, one of the things I feel the most sorry for, and felt so tragically, it was so tragic that at the end of his life, where we as a family had really worked to forgive him, he had not yet forgiven himself. And so I feel like he passed before he could feel that grace within himself. And so I struggle with that still. I struggle with forgiving myself for some of the things that I have done, the things that I have, places I have harmed myself and others. There's just so much grace as well. And there's so much life on the other side of the cave.
Yeah. Gosh, I relate so much to everything you just shared. And I think it'll be relatable to so many people listening. And I just want to say again that I appreciate your oversharing and vulnerability. I think we need more of that to feel less alone in our struggles. And I am curious how all of this ties into you as a creative and like the vocational life that you live. Like, how has this journey actually led you to a fuller or even a new understanding of creativity? How has it impacted your work? Because there is an intersection here between if you wouldn't have gotten the help you needed and continued to choose to pursue like a life that's, I'll phrase it my words, in the light, a transparent life in the light.
Yep.
Where do you think you'd be today? Like, what would be different? Would you still be married? How would your relationship with your daughters be? Like, what would your work look like? How does this intersect on that level?
Yep. I think, so I'm 43, and I was pretty sure in kind of the height of my addiction, I was never going to get married, maybe until I was 40. Maybe then I would settle down and have kids. And so, I mean, firstly, I don't know if I'd be alive, to be honest. And I don't know if I would be married, still married, or have our three amazing daughters. So I think that to me, it's hard to fathom now when I look at the life that I have now to realize how close I was to never being able to experience any of this. And then I think an answer to your question of like what the creative part of it. I think that all healing is a creative act. And so for me, something I talk about in the book, a big switch that I had, which is after I had attended graduate school, which was essentially a 2-year-long recovery process for me, and Margaret and I got married, that I was looking at all these old clippings from when I was an actor and articles that had been written about me or things that I had directed, and realized it was so easy for me to create in that vein. Why was it so hard to do some of the same things and have such a great imagination about my own life in ways that came so easy for me in this whole other space? And so there is a tool that I learned when I was in graduate school that I think is really helpful and probably a really tangible, probably takeaway. In school, we talked about this idea of time. We think of it as linear, right? Past, present, future. It just kind of moves in that kind of up and to the right place. But the way we experience time is inverted. It's past, future, present. And basically, it means that anything that happened in the past, good or bad, but definitely bad, we project onto the future. And then however we imagine the future is how we live in the present. And so if you want to change your future, you actually have to change your past, which we would say, how on earth can you do that? You can't change your past. In fact, when you look at those two things, three, past, present, future, which one can you actually change? Well, that's the one you can't. It's said and done. It's over. But the truth is, most of us are unreliable narrators of our past. And that was something that I realized. I needed to go back into some of those dark moments of my trauma, my abuse specifically, and realize, well, yes, I had been a victim. Could there be something redemptive in that story? And now that is not to condone sexual violence or abuse in any sort of way. But as we go back and reinterpret the stories of our past, I think we'd all find that there are moments of redemption that would alter the character of that story, right? And so if we change just even like a degree of our story, that we found a little bit of hope or redemption in the worst thing that ever happened to us, that would cause us, again, just a degree to imagine, well, maybe the future is going to be a little different as well. Like maybe that won't happen again, or maybe that will happen in a different way. And when we imagine a future that's different, we live completely differently in the present. And to me, I was like, oh my gosh, that's the creative act. It's imagining something and then trying to work it out in the present and kind of bring it into fruition. And so for me, I think of every day like that. How do I imagine my future with my family, with my wife, with these daughters? And let that be the driver of what changes my actions in the present. And so it does, it feels like very alive and very creative in my own life. Whereas, when I was deep into my addiction, it was the most boring thing you could imagine. It was so predictable. A friend of one of my very good friends, his brother, recently told him, and this is in the book as well, that he was getting a divorce. And I said, what did you say to him when he told you that? He said, that's so boring. So boring. Like, how predictable that, of course, that's what's happening. That's what you're doing. And I'm like, I don't want to live a boring life. I know what that is. I know that story. I know how it ends. My dad ended in that way. And I want something more alive. I want something more creative. I want something more fruitful, more risky, that takes more imagination, than, I think I probably even can muster. But to me, every day feels like a creative act.
I love this. I'm going to have to go back and re-listen to our conversation just to sit with your description of the past, present, future, like all of that, because
the space-time continuum.
Yeah, I want to like chew on that longer, because I mean, it totally makes sense. Like what you envision for your future would inform your present. Like the way, yeah, if I am very clear on what I want the future to look like, then of course, if I choose to be intentional with my present, then I can build towards that future.
Sure.
But what you said about the past, like going back and like even just by a degree, relooking at the narrative and the character and the learnings and the, that's going to be interesting. I love that.
Yeah, because most of us are unaware of how much our past is still informing what we think will happen in the future. Most of us are on autopilot in many ways because the trauma we've experienced and the pain that we've suffered. And that is our past, the thing that we said is done, is over, you can't change it, still very much drives how we imagine the future. And so that is the place to start. And so yes. I definitely agree that, yes, we need to be forward looking and manifest, you know, and think about what it is that we want for our future. But unless we have done some of the work to re-narrate the past, we're always going to get tripped up in a narrative that we probably don't even realize is still very active in our lives.
Totally. Yeah, this is so good. And I know she won't care if I share this, but like, I even have this thought about like my mom, right? I was like, okay, my mom like grew up with like very little in her life, in her childhood, in her story. And so like, it makes sense that she would struggle with a scarcity mindset of like, even now she's just had the coolest transformation journey and like just who she is and what she's done. Like I always tell people, my mom's my hero. It's like, I look at her life and I'm able to be like, okay, mom, you're never going to run out of money. Like you're doing great.
Right.
But she, because of that past, like still probably, and I know, again, I know she wouldn't care if I share this, but like lives struggling through that scarcity mindset because of her past. And so yes, on so many levels, yes, underscore, highlight, bold, cosign, that our past impacts us more than we realize. And, but the work is available to all of us to revisit it to go back there. So good. Well, I know we're getting to the end of our conversation, but I thought we would end with, your family motto. Cause I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
And I'm all about like living a really intentional life. And so I thought, why don't you just describe your family motto and tell us a little bit about how you use that as a family with your daughters, to motivate yourself.
Yep. So, it's 5 phrases, I think. We say it all the time, so I'm not even sure of the numbers. So we'll count together. But it's something that we say, my wife and I, and then our girls repeat every phrase back and forth. It's kind of like our liturgy, every single day, always when we drop them off to school or somewhere else. And it's be kind, have courage, fail, ask for help, and do it afraid. And so be kind, have courage. We actually stole from the new Cinderella film. I don't know if you've seen it. It's really beautiful. It's what the father says to Cinderella, just to always be kind, to have courage. Fail, we got from, if you're familiar with the founder of Spanx, she was giving an interview. And this may be folklore, but it's in the book, so now it's true, that she was asked in the interview, how did you become such a successful entrepreneur? And she said, oh, I got really comfortable with failure. Well, how did you do that? Well, my dad, instead of asking us when we got home from school, what did you do at school or how was school? He would say, how did you fail today? Mm-hmm. And so it could be as simple as, I tried to say hello to the new kid and they ignored me. And what they would do is celebrate their failures. And so that is something that we have embraced. So be kind, have courage, fail. Ask for help is just I would not be here today if I had not at that one point and then many, many points beyond that. And even today, been like, I don't know what I'm doing. I need to ask for help. And I think the older you get, the less comfortable you are at asking for help because you feel like you should have it figured out by now. But we don't, and you don't, and I don't, and that's okay. So we just need each other. We need to ask for help. And then The story that I always tell for the last part, Dude Afraid, is my daughter had gone to a volleyball camp, and she was the youngest of all of them. And we were leaving, and or I was leaving, and it was clear because no parents were not allowed. She was probably 8. And so I was getting kicked out, and she was like, "Don't go, don't go." And I could see tears in her eyes. And I said our motto up to that date, which was be kind, have courage, fail, ask for help. And then she said, "Dude Afraid." And I was like, that's it. That's it. That's what our work is. Our work is to do it afraid. I know that in scripture, if you are a person of the Bible, many, many times it says, do not be afraid. We're told that, angels say it all the time in the stories. And some people could say, oh, well, they're doing that so that we are not afraid. But I actually think it's such a lovely reminder to be like, it's okay that you are, but that doesn't mean you can't keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. That we'll say to our girls that they're at a playground, oh yeah, you're afraid, but you're also so brave. And so it's this yes and approach to thinking that I actually, as an actor, have always had terrible stage fright. And so I've just had to learn to keep moving onto the stage despite being afraid. I don't have any sort of superhuman skill about being courageous. And I am not fearless in any regard. Most of the time, I'm afraid. And so those are the things we say every single day. And then, do you know Lindsay Letters by any chance?
I do, yeah. Okay. I followed her journey. I think it was since their daughter's accident that I came across her. But I know there's also friends that are probably mutual friends of you and I that we talked about pre-show that are also friends with her. So it's a small world.
So we've been friends with Lindsay for a very long time. And when I said, hey, for my launch of the book, I want to be able to share something, but I want to use your artwork. Would you design our family motto? And in one, like probably like at 2 a.m., she just got some watercolors out and made this beautiful design. And then when we moved into this neighborhood, which today is, we're recording, this is our 1 year anniversary here in this town, south of Atlanta. And Lindsay sent me this beautiful design, and I got a local muralist to create a 9-foot by 12-foot mural that sits in the main community space of our little neighborhood, our little town. And so now every day, not only does our family see our family motto, but our whole neighborhood does. Wow. And hopefully is encouraged by it as well. So just like a really fun little thing. So I'll make sure to share some photos of that and the artwork as well.
I love that so much. Oh, that's so cool. Well, I have absolutely loved this. I loved reading your book, and I'm so glad we finally got around to having this conversation.
I know.
Especially as a Longer Table podcast is coming to an end.
I know. It's so sad.
But I love that for a few more weeks, we have these pop-up episodes with people I love and have gotten to know and respect. And so thanks for being here at our table and sharing your story. There's so much wisdom to unpack in what you shared. So I can't wait for people to hear it. But yeah, hopefully one day when I'm back in Chicago and you're back in Chicago, because otherwise I'm not sure when it'll happen, our families will meet in person.
Yes, I love that. And it's probably more likely that we'll be in LA. So we'll
see you go.
At your place.
Perfect. You're welcome. Amazing. At my table in real life.
Yay.